Hey everyone, I'm Scott Cunningham, aka Scottsy Business, and today we're finally back with another episode where we're going to talk about the Ethereum merge, and I'm going to explain the misconceptions and some of the things that people aren't really sure about or, you know, kind of up in the air, as well as just kind of break it down very simply as to what actually has happened and what has changed and where we're going with the rest of the phases of the merge. As you'll notice, I'm in the new studio. I'll talk a little bit about my move and all the complications and things that I've had this month in my monthly update. So I won't take up any time with that on this video. So without further ado, after a quick word from my sponsor, we're going to jump into all that good stuff today.
A big thank you and shout out to my sponsor, Cake Wallet, which is an open source, non-custodial Bitcoin and Monero wallet that also has a built-in exchange. It's available on iOS and Android.
All right. Thanks again to my sponsor. So right out the gate, I'll say I was a little wrong as well as to what I thought exactly was going to happen with the ETH merge. So, you know, like to be completely fair, a lot of people were kind of confused as to what exactly was changing. And one of the biggest things is that gas fees and such and scalability is not really going to change until we see the first major phase, which is called the surge. I'll go through all that in a little bit. But that's one of the biggest misconceptions to just, you know, knock out right away. Nothing has really drastically changed from the user perspective, aside from the fact that you can now stake, but most users don't have 50 grand lying around. So again, for the average user of Ethereum, nothing is really changing. The ticker is the same. You don't have to do anything to switch over. A lot of it is all just done on the back end and really not a lot for you to worry about. So if anything, you're probably just here to better understand what has happened and what are some of the changes that have occurred, as well as what is actually coming and when are we finally going to get better scalability and lower gas fees. I'm sure that's the biggest question most people have. So if you're very new to the crypto world, a lot of the older coins run on proof of work, like Bitcoin, etc. And that takes a lot of mining power and, you know, it's one way to form consensus. A lot of newer coins that have been coming out have been proof of stake consensus. Ethereum has just switched from proof of work to proof of stake. This is bad for the miners and it centralized it a little bit, but we'll talk about that and how we could address that in the future. But the main sort of change is that it's 99.5 or something percent more efficient in terms of energy use. This is the big one because obviously the big narrative is that crypto is bad for the environment because of proof of mining, proof of work mining. And people will always say against Bitcoin, you know, oh, it's bad for the environment because it uses so much electricity, even though I'm going to be doing a whole breakdown on this that, you know, gold mining, if you're comparing Bitcoin to gold, gold is all diesel. And, you know, a lot of it's nonsense because most of Bitcoin mining is done with renewable energy anyways. All that aside, in terms of marketing and like brand and stuff, Ethereum made itself much, much more approachable for all these massive enterprises that all care about ESG scores and, you know, everything about, you know, improving the environment, which, you know, making the environment better for all of us is great. But when it's kind of a weird narrative with ESG. I mean, it's not really for the environment. That's what they say. But it's obviously, to a lot of people, it's very clear that ESG scores are really meant to hurt small businesses and basically take out competition. Like originally, they didn't like Bitcoin, so they were saying that. But now you don't really hear anyone complaining about the energy use of Bitcoin because it's being adopted. Although it really seems like there's much bigger adoption like coming up for Ethereum from major enterprises and things like that. Anyways, though, the biggest change is that it's going to be 99.95% more efficient. All the tickers will stay the same. Again, not a lot is changing from the user perspective. We're calling ETH1 the execution layer where transactions are handled, and ETH2 is the proof of stake consensus for validators. Essentially just meaning that all the transactions and things that you're doing are just on the layer one, and everything for staking is on layer two. So it's a little confusing because for a while the ETH merge was being called ETH 2.0, but now ETH 2 really just refers to layer two. So a little confusing, but that's just a change of some of the wording that they use. So not a big deal. Addressing some of the misconceptions though, and again, I took some of this from CoinDesk, or rather, and I link everything, of course, but I learned a lot of this stuff from CoinDesk's article, which breaks this down really well. I'm just more so breaking this down even further and summarizing it even more, just getting the best parts out of it, and then obviously doing the video for you guys. So with that being said, let's continue. So yeah, gas fees will not be improved until the surge. Another big misconception is that you need 32 ETH to be a validator or to, you know, help secure the network. While you do need 32 ETH to stake and earn, anyone can still technically start up a node and you can, you know, help secure the network, and you can fight against the centralization issues that we're currently having that I will bring up in a moment. But you absolutely can. And if you are concerned about Ethereum centralization, you can run your own node for free. That's the caveat. You're not going to earn rewards and things. But yeah, it really just depends how serious you are about securing the network or not. To each their own, right? But it's a little misleading to say that as well, because, you know, I mean, people probably aren't largely going to do that. And 32 ETH is a really big commitment. The big issue right now, though, as I was just saying with centralization, is that all the services and exchanges that offer ETH staking, they're getting a lot of the people who are going in and staking with them, since people can't do it without 32 unless they go into a pool and stake with a bunch of other people all together. Unfortunately, about 55% of all staked Ethereum or so is staked with four exchanges: Lido, Kraken, Coinbase, and I'm forgetting. Oh, and Binance, obviously. I've got it here. I'll find this in my notes. This is a lot of information, so I'm trying to be as quick and concise and summarized as possible. You do have to remember that, like, while withdrawals are not currently enabled for staking, you can't really get your stuff out for a really long time anyways. But even when that does happen, withdrawals currently are not enabled, so you wouldn't be able to get your ETH out. The ETH withdrawals will come with the first phase upgrade called the surge. And I don't think that's a big concern, but it's definitely a risk that you have to understand going in, that if for some reason they just keep delaying, you might not have the ability to withdraw at all. I think that's pretty important to understand, but I'm not that worried that they won't be able to follow through on that, because ETH will really fall apart if everyone loses their trust in it and they think they're like stealing your money. So I don't think that's really an issue, but it's something that you have to be aware of. And while you can't get your ETH out until the withdrawals and the lockup is done, you will still receive fees and MEV immediately, even though you're not able to withdraw your actual stake. You can still get your rewards as you go. So you're not getting nothing. You're still able to get something for what you're putting in. You're just not getting that 32 ETH back right away or very easily. So again, something to keep in mind: you're not getting nothing, but until withdrawals are there, you're very limited in what you're able to do. And then there's the concern that when withdrawals are enabled, everyone will just try to exit at once, and they've prepared for this as well. So the limitations on how many people can exit from being a validator is 6 per epoch. And an epoch is every 6.4 minutes. That's about 1350 epochs a day, or about 43,000 ETH per day. Out of the current 14 million Ethereum staked, that's close to a year for all validators to exit. However, the APR, the yield of how much you're going to earn for staking your ETH, is dynamic and will go up as validators exit, giving incentive for other people to then come in and replace them, and you know, just keep that balanced, and there won't be a mass exodus all at once. So I think they've addressed a lot of really important concerns and kind of cleared a lot of that up. And a lot of this is coming directly from the Ethereum.org website. What we're getting into now, which is the actual explanation of the phases, is what I mostly pulled from CoinDesk, which I mentioned earlier. But just before we get into that, talking about the staking concentration and centralization, apparently Lido is currently making up about 30% of all the staked Ethereum. According to Ethereum.org staking, there's about 432,000 validators staking 14.6 million Ethereum as of writing this. And according to Dune.com, where you can get analytics on cryptocurrency, you can see that there's about 84,000 unique depositors for Lido. However, Lido claims there's 189,000 stakers. I don't know how many are unique depositors, or, you know, however that works, but, you know, that's just what they're saying. Either way, it's way too much ETH being staked by single entities, because, again, like anything, if you're giving Lido your Ethereum to stake on your behalf, they have the ETH, not you, them. If they get hacked, if they just want to steal your ETH, if anything happens, you know, your ETH is gone. So that's a huge risk in of itself. And if you've been watching this channel, I always say, you know, not your keys, not your crypto, just like everyone else says, you should never leave your cryptocurrency on exchanges or services that require you to give up the ownership of your crypto. Meaning, if it's not simply in a wallet that you control and you have the keys to only, it's at risk. So depositing with all these stakers is probably, you know, really ideal for people who are sitting on ETH and they're like, I want to keep holding this ETH. I don't intend to sell it anytime soon, and I'm leaving it on the exchange already, which, again, you shouldn't be. So I'm assuming most of these people are like not as well in the know in terms of best practices. But it's, you know, seems very easy. You can just stake on Binance, or you can stake on Lido or whatever. And I believe they're offering a higher APY than if you just directly staked too. So, I mean, people have so much incentive to just use these pools. And like anything, when it's more convenient, it always comes with a catch. Just like if you buy crypto on PayPal, it's kind of more convenient, but you can only buy it or sell it. You can't transfer it or actually use it. You don't truly own it. You take on all this extra risk and you don't really get the benefits of what crypto is actually trying to offer by doing it this way. So again, it's about 55% of all staked ETH currently is in these four exchanges: Binance, Lido, Coinbase, and Kraken. This is very concerning. However, about a year ago, Lido made up 65% of the stake. So it is trending down generally, which is good to see, but we need it to be at the very minimum, like below 50%. So people could either actually stake themselves if they have the money to put up, or if you're really concerned about centralization in Ethereum, you can start spinning up your own node and trying to do that as well. And maybe I'll take a crack at it just to see how effective it is, and, you know, how easy or challenging it is to actually do. But I think it's worth understanding how useful that could be, especially if you're genuinely concerned about it being too centralized. Because again, that's one of the biggest criticisms, is that it's becoming more centralized because of all of this. But if those people are serious, they can do something about it, or they can just go to a different chain, which, you know, it's up to each their own to make that decision. Now, we'll dive into the four phases of Ethereum. So we just had the merge, which is originally just switching over from proof of work to proof of stake, and, you know, massively improving the electricity usage, et cetera, et cetera. But what everyone's really, really, really waiting for is the surge. The first update supposed to come in early 2023. By the end of all these updates, we will have about 100,000 transactions per second. And gas fees can go as low as half a cent to 5 cents, which is what Vitalik shared at the Futurist Conference in Toronto that I attended in August. And the 100,000 is what he also said there and what they say on the website, ethereum.org as well, which would make them one of the best chains out there. I sort of look at this in terms of like, okay, well, Cosmos is one of my favorite alternatives and they can do about 10,000 at best, as far as I'm aware. If this can do 10x what they can do with all the continued utility and usage, and Ethereum is just going to be so far ahead of everything else. I mean, even Hive, my favorite social media blockchain platform, they do 10,000 transactions a second as well. If Ethereum can do 10x that, imagine what possibilities we could start taking advantage of in terms of social media blockchain platforms on Ethereum. Yeah, you can't write content the same way, so and the gas fees are still higher, but it makes it very, very possible. So I'm very curious to see how all this plays out. The two main things that the surge is going to do that is actually going to make this possible is it's going to introduce sharding, which I know everyone kind of giggles, but shard, like a shard of like a gem. Sharding is where Ethereum is going to have all these side chains and or mini blockchains, and we're calling them shards. They're going to run a bunch of transactions and then send all of those transactions in a bundle compressed as one transaction to the main chain. This would mean that you could effectively scale it as many times as you're able to, how many transactions and how many side chains. Right now, they're proposing to do 64 side chains or linked databases, and each doing around, you know, if we're just ballparking to try to get to that 100,000, let's say, you know, we've got 15 transactions per second currently. That's what Ethereum is at right now, which is dismal compared to what we're going to get to, which is going to be insane. We run 960 transactions per second with those 64 databases, and then that can scale basically 100x because you can run many transactions in those databases, right? So this is a little complex. I'm getting a little bit into the math. So what I did originally is I said, okay, if we have, you know, pull up a calculator here just to verify everything. If we have 15 times 64, that's 960. That means at the very beginning, we've got 960 transactions per second. But then you're going to times that by 100 because we've got the ability to do, you know, say like 100 transactions per transaction on these 64 chains. So what that would look like is, you know, say I send 100 transactions to 100 people. Right? Like one transaction to each person to 100 people. All of that gets put into one single transaction and sent back to the main chain. So in the main chain, those 100 transactions looks like just one single transaction. And that's from one side chain. But then you've got 64 side chains all doing those 100 transactions and sending those back. And that was just 64 transactions on the main chain. But in reality, that was actually 64 on each sidechain times 100 sent back to the main chain. And I'm just kind of ballparking here because I don't have the exact numbers, but generally that's how you would get to about 100,000 transactions per second. And effectively, it's just like you're bundling them all up and kind of compressing them, like when you compress something with like 7-zip and then you zip the file and then you uncompress it and, you know, you get everything back out of that file. This is just a very efficient way of doing that on the blockchain. So again, it's like you've got separate chains. They're all running all the stuff for you, sending it all back as one transaction, and then the main chain has that. So that's kind of a sloppy way to explain sharding, but essentially, too long didn't read is just, this is going to massively improve Ethereum. But sharding by itself is not actually going to get us to 100,000. That this is just my easier way of explaining what I'm talking about. Everything together, or at least the first three phases, will get us to the 100,000. So sharding might get us probably to like about 10,000 transactions per second. But either way, I mean, it'll still put it on par with every other blockchain that's competing with Ethereum and saying, oh, we're better because we do this faster or cheaper or whatever. Again, I really like Cosmos, Atom, and we'll be on the same level of transaction speed, etc., by this first phase, supposedly. So very, very, very awesome. And yeah, I mean, eventually it'll be running over 6,000 times faster than it is now, or more transactions at the very least. Because again, we're at 15 per second right now, and we're going to 100,000 by the end of the year. Absolutely insane amount of scalability. Plus, with the surge, they're also going to introduce rollups so that they can perform transactions outside of Ethereum's base layer and then post data to the main layer. Some of the stuff is a little more technical, so I won't really dive into all about what rollups are. Just, you know, at base value, it's going to make things faster. Simplifying the data, allowing us to do more on different layers, and just, it's just making it faster, to put it simply. The next phase, and that'll be the main phase that everyone's really waiting for, but the next phase that will come after that is the Verge, which will tackle scalability again, but they will be doing this by changing their proofs from Merkle proofs to Verkle proofs. Again, very technical, I won't get into it, but it's really just to optimize storage and reduce node sizes. And that's just going to very much improve congestion and scalability. The Purge is the third phase that will focus on reducing data, unnecessary data rather, to clean up the blockchain and help with network congestion. And by the end of this phase, we should have that 100,000 transactions per second. This is mainly just kind of going through and cleaning it up and making things take up less data and space and just improving it, very simply. The final phase, which Vitalik calls the phase for the fun stuff, is called the Splurge. This will mainly focus on other network updates and fixing anything else that they missed that won't cause any issues, you know, hopefully no downtime or anything like that. But the Splurge is just kind of the extra stuff to add on there. But 90% of what is actually super important is going to be in the other three phases. Technically, I'm not counting the Merge as a phase, but it's technically five phases, with the Merge being the first phase. Either way, I've also linked the CoinDesk article that actually kind of breaks down all the phases, and I've also linked Ethereum and everything, all the information there as well. But that's essentially it for my breakdown. I know it's a little convoluted, but I wanted to just sort of break it down in the way that I understand it and try to relay that to you as best as possible. I know sometimes it's a little more technical, and I'm kind of jumping through some of the more technical stuff, but regardless, it was a success. We have merged. Now we're working towards the next major phases. Centralization is an issue, but I think it's going to improve over time. And either way, we're still going to get so much adoption with Ethereum. And once we reach that 10,000 transactions from the first upgrade, the surge, I think it's just going to be so, so bullish for Ethereum. And 2023 is going to probably be very bullish once we start to see that actually play out, leading into the next halving, and then go super bullish from there. So at this point, I don't expect a lot until we get that. But, you know, I still have high hopes going forward, and I'm still always generally long-term bullish for crypto. But that's it. That's everything. Let me know what you guys think. Were you expecting something different from the merge? You know, are you upset that fees haven't really changed? Do you think that the surge will actually come on time in early 2023? What are your thoughts on Ethereum going forward? Is this good news for Ethereum? Is this bad news? How do you feel about the centralization aspect? Let me know all that good stuff in the comments below. Will you run a node to help with the decentralization? You let me know. I might try to tackle that myself, but we'll see. Make sure to comment hashtag #1ham in the comments below. And that way I know you watched the whole video from start to finish. And I always appreciate those of you who do. I'm Scott Cunningham, aka Scottsy Business, signing off. Cheers.